Coming up on the second hour of Mid-Morning, the Mid-Morning Book Club opens a new chapter. This time we're talking about Joseph Conrad's chilling novel, Heart of Darkness. Why does Kurtz remain one of the most haunting villains of modern literature? Mid-Morning Book Club, when we continue in a moment, stay with us. First News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. The government says the U.S. economy shrank significantly in the final quarter of 2008, but Richard Ebeling of the American Institute for Economic Research says the new report on gross domestic product contains some modest encouragement.
The fourth quarter decline of about 3.8% in GDP is a lot less than many analysts and forecasters had been predicting. So that's sort of the good news.
President Obama said the recession is deepening. He said just moments ago, "I believe if we act boldly and swiftly, we can overcome this crisis." Japanese automakers once thought invincible are facing tough times in a tough economy, though they are not as troubled as Detroit companies. Japanese news reports say Toyota expects to post its first full-year net loss ever, and Honda says its most recently quarterly profit fell 90% from a year before. Honda's problems extend past the U.S. markets to other markets, including Britain, as Larry Miller reports from London.
Honda is mothballing its UK operation for at least 4 months. 2,500 workers at Honda's Swindon plant will receive full basic pay for the first 2 months and then around 60%. Honda says it has no plans for layoffs and is taking the move to safeguard employment for its workers, though it was giving no guarantees about the future. The head of the plant said if car sales in the next 3 months clear the backlog, the production line could be running again by June. When the plant reopens, workers will pay back the amount they've received during the shutdown in unpaid overtime. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
Iraqi voters head to the polls tomorrow to pick provincial councils from more than 14,000 candidates. NPR's J.J. Sutherland reports from Najaf.
It's the first time that all sections of Iraqi society are expected to participate. Sunnis boycotted the elections in 2005. While the country has been relatively peaceful in the run-up to the voting, three people running for office were assassinated yesterday, bringing the total to at least six that have been killed this campaign. Massive security is expected tomorrow. Iraq will close its national borders and airports and ban cars from the cities as people go to vote. In the north and west of the country, Sunni participation is expected to dramatically reshape the provincial councils. In some provinces, minority religious and ethnic groups are now in charge. In the Shiite-dominated south, the two most powerful parties, who are partners in a ruling coalition at the federal level, are battling fiercely for seats in the provinces. J.J. Sutherland, NPR News, Najaf, Iraq.
Wall Street stocks are down. The Dow Jones Industrials down 70 points at 80.78. The Nasdaq Composite is down 12 at 14.95. Once again, President Obama is speaking, and he is encouraging Congress to take action on his economic stimulus plan in view of the most recent economic reports out this morning. This is NPR News.
Support for news comes from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication. On the web at annenbergfoundation.org.
From Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm Perry Vanelli. A provision in the federal stimulus package could put Governor Tim Pawlenty's proposal to cut health care costs in jeopardy. The House bill would funnel nearly $2 billion directly to health care programs, but states that accept that money would not be able to change rules governing who's eligible for such benefits. Pawlenty has proposed reducing state health care benefits in an effort to fix the proposed budget deficit. Pawlenty says the Senate still has to take up the stimulus package, so the governor is taking a wait-and-see approach. The state's education commissioner says a bad ranking in a new study only renews the need for legislation this year to make improvements to teacher quality. The National Council on Teacher Quality gave the state a D in each of three areas. They included finding effective new teachers, hanging on to the best new teachers, and getting rid of the worst. For one, the study cites the fact that teachers who have not yet passed the state licensure test can still teach with a waiver, but Commissioner Alice Segrin says many of these issues are well known.
They have identified some areas where we need improvement. So we are, and in fact, we're doing a lot of the things that they want to do, but it just takes time.
Governor Tim Pawlenty is again pushing for tougher standards for students studying to become teachers, as well as for graduates testing for their teaching licenses. The governor also wants to make a merit pay program called QComp mandatory. It's currently voluntary. A state House crime panel meets this morning to consider designating October as Domestic Violence Awareness Month. The bill notes the pain and suffering, lost work time, health care costs, and other negative effects of domestic violence. High temperatures around Minnesota today, anywhere from 10 to 25 degrees. Right now, it's mostly sunny in the Twin Cities, temperature one above. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Programming is supported by the Shakopee Mittawakaton Sioux community. Since 2004, donating 199 automatic external defibrillators to the Minnesota State Patrol. Information on requesting an AED for your organization is at ShakopeeDakota.org.
This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. This hour, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. A European newspaper recently rated Conrad's Mr. Kurtz as number 9 on a list of 50 top literary villains. And if you joined our mid-morning book club this month and read or reread Heart of Darkness with us, you certainly know why. Kurtz is the organist and scholar turned ivory trader who ventures deep into the darkness of the Congo and is ultimately consumed by greed and corruption. The novel has been variously interpreted as a fictional representation of the genocide that went on in colonial Africa, a journey into the dissolution of old Europe, and the consummate representation of evil. It also explores a theme that Conrad was interested in throughout his writing, human nature at its extremes. So today, as we open a new chapter of our book club, we're going to talk about why this novel, published at the turn of the 20th century, remains so relevant today. We'll explore the criticism of it, leveled both by other writers and literary critics. We'll talk about Conrad's life as a writer and the representation of the novel in the Francis Ford Coppola film Apocalypse Now. All of that in our conversation today with our guest. John Peters is an associate professor of English at the University of North Texas and a past president of the Joseph Conrad Society. He's the author of Conrad and Impressionism, and he's with us this morning from Denton, Texas. Professor, good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Deborah Romanek Baldwin is with us. She's associate professor of English at the University of Dallas, and she's with us this morning from Dallas, Texas. Professor Baldwin, thank you for joining us.
Hello.
Professor Peters, it had been a long time since I had read this novel, and when I went back to reread it, I was struck by how accurately Conrad foretold the genocide in Rwanda, what's been going on in Zimbabwe. The tragedy of this novel, I would say, is that more than 100 years later, it is as relevant as it was then. Tell me what strikes you about that.
Well, I think that that's an interesting observation. Of course, it was focused primarily on the problems that were occurring in Belgium, in the Belgian Congo at the time.
Yeah.
Certainly there, you know, is representative of things that could happen under that colonial system. And even though we're in a post-colonial world now, of course, all of those, indigenous cultures and the like were mixed up, boundaries were changed, and so forth. And so many of the influences of that colonial rule still, are at play there. And it's still difficult for, I think, many of those societies to get past some of the things that occurred during that time.
Professor Peters, I know you teach this novel. Do you teach it not just as a work of literature, but do you teach this as an important historical novel?
Well, both. Of course, it was extremely influential, but it did speak to historical and cultural issues of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that many people didn't pick up on that right away and didn't recognize some of the criticisms of colonialism that existed in the novel at the time it was written, although some did, certainly. But certainly the things that it depicts are things that have continued to occur since then, and, as you say, have occurred in even recent history.
Yeah, Professor Baldwin, I wonder how important you think it is to teach this not just as a work of literature, but as a novel that reflects a real place and a real time and has something to say about what's going on now.
Well, yes, that is important. I would say, however, that I would look past certainly the African continent, and even past extreme conditions of colonialism, and think about other sorts of extreme conditions and the effect of the general culture on an individual in making particular decisions. I think the novel has very deep psychological implications that go beyond the historical moment. Conrad himself took out some of the names.
Huh.
The names of cities, perhaps in an attempt to universalize it somewhat. And so while the historical is important, I don't think it's definitive. The most important historical angle, I think, is just the fact that Conrad himself traveled up the Congo and was trying to be faithful to the particulars of his own experience.
You've said that you think Conrad was testing the idea of how fragile our humanity is. Do you mean this idea of what happens to people when you remove all, you know, social and cultural boundaries?
I wouldn't phrase it in terms of removing the boundaries, because that implies that human nature at its core is Kurds. But rather, if you put people in extreme conditions, you can reduce them to a state of a sort of hollowness, an absence of humanity. And I think that's an important difference that Primo Levi makes. He was an Auschwitz survivor who wrote an account of his experience in the camps. Survival in Auschwitz, or Sequestue in Uomo, and he describes the emptiness of this human being who has had all comforts removed, who can't depend on those around him, who's pushed to being an animal, pushed to being gutted.
So, Professor Peters, I'm curious about where you come down on that. I mean, do you think this evil that we see manifested in Kurtz has always resided there, and it's just unleashed because, again, he's somewhere where the societal and cultural boundaries don't exist? Or do you see it as Professor Baldwin is telling us, that he is pushed to become this?
Well, I think it's sort of both, really. I think that certainly he is pushed by extreme circumstances, but that is one of the things that Conrad does investigate in the novel that you suggest. You know, what happens to individuals when you remove those restraints, as he says in it? You know, what happens when there are no laws or public opinion or things of that sort? You know, how do people respond then to the circumstances? Because, you know, if you look at not just Kurtz, but the other Europeans that show up in the novel, there is very little... there are few examples of individuals who practice what Marlowe calls restraint, and who don't behave in essentially a sort of uncivilized manner.
So, Professor Baldwin, what is Conrad telling us about this?
Well, I would agree with what Professor Peters just said, focusing on the characters other than Kurtz, that it's not only Kurtz who is the example of gutted humanity, but rather the other Europeans and even the battered victims of that experience, such as the Africans in the Grove of Death. Interestingly, the example of restraint that the novel gives us are the so-called cannibals who don't eat Marlowe. And in a somewhat problematical passage, Marlowe is meditating on, does he not look appetizing enough? Where did this restraint come from? But somehow these people that you think are going to have no restraint are the ones that do have the restraint. And the ones that you expect will have all the restraint because they have all the so-called civilization end up being the opposite.
Do you both teach this, once a year or every other year? To students,
I teach it probably once a year would be about right. occasionally more often.
So do your has the reaction from your students to the novel changed?
I don't think I've noticed a significant change in any particular way.
How about you, Professor Baldwin?
I would agree. I think students are captivated by the book. They're interested in it and also often confused by it because it's not a very straightforward book. It's a book that complicates all of its own moral issues, and in and of itself, it's a very complicated little narrative. So I think it's hard to have a simple reaction to the book.
I do, too, because I found that, and maybe you've both had this experience, I found that having read it, I think in my senior year of high school, I missed a lot of it, didn't understand a lot of what Conrad was trying to do. And even something like the plot became much clearer in going back to reread it. Professor Peters, how many times have you read it? And is something new revealed every time?
Oh, well, that's a difficult question. I mean, I suppose I've read it a dozen or a couple of dozen times, at least, since I teach it so frequently, and I do tend to reread it on a relatively regular basis. You know, I do notice some different things as I reread. I pick up things that maybe I haven't seen before. And certainly that would be most people's experience between the first and second reading, at least.
Yeah, I think so, too. If you're listening in this morning on Mid-Morning, we've reopened a chapter of the Mid-Morning Book Club, and we have read Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. We're talking with two guests this morning about some of the themes that Conrad was exploring in it. I mentioned in the at the introduction here to the show that a European newspaper recently rated Mr. Kurtz as number 9 on a list of 50 top literary villains. We'll talk about that a bit more. We're also going to play a short excerpt here from a film that follows the story of this Heart of Darkness, Apocalypse Now. So we'll talk about the comparisons there. If you'd like to join the conversation this morning, you've read the novel a while ago, you have some thoughts about it, maybe you reread it with us as part of the book club. Like to hear from you on that. 800-242-2828. If you're listening in the metro area, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, online at minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. John Peters with us, an associate professor of English at the University of North Texas, and Deborah Baldwin, associate professor of English at the University of Dallas. Online here from Paul in Elk River says, Kurtz perverted the brutality that he found towards his own ends. Creepy because we're surrounded by the brutality of nature, ripe for perversion. Professor Baldwin, what do you make of that?
I could you read that last line again? That last phrase I missed.
Yes,
we're surrounded by.
Yes, he says Kurtz perverted the brutality that he found towards his own ends, and Paul says creepy because we're surrounded by the brutality of nature, ripe for perversion.
That's an interesting angle on it. I don't know that nature, that the jungle is as much the focus of perversion as I take that somewhat ironically, that Marlowe starts thinking that the darkness is nature, and then he discovers the darkness is in the human thing,
yes,
and even in himself. So I guess I focus a bit less on the nature as a literal source of certainly moral darkness, even if it is physical darkness.
Professor Peters, I know this has been a long-running debate. A question here from Joe in Minneapolis. Is Heart of Darkness a racist book, or is it anti-racist?
Well,
it was bound to come up, right?
Yeah, that's actually a somewhat complicated issue, I guess you could say. Of course, that originally comes from Chinua Achebe's famous essay in which he argued two things. One, that Conrad's portrayal of the Africans was racist, and two, that as a result, Heart of Darkness is not a great work of literature. As far as the first part of that goes, well, there are a couple of things. One is, of course, you know, we are talking about race relations over 100 years ago. You know, I think you could argue that Conrad is a product of his time, and also that in some ways Conrad is less racist than others of his contemporaries. Also, of course, we do see the plight of the Africans in Heart of Darkness, and they're treated more sympathetically, certainly, than the European characters. At the same time, though, Achebe has always been particularly interested in the idea of the portrayal of Africans by European writers. He wrote his first novel as a response to a review that he saw of Joyce Carey's Mr. Johnson, which talked about this wonderful presentation of African characters, and this sort of infuriated Achebe, and so he wrote this novel because his complaint was that he felt that European writers, since the 19th century, had been portraying Africans as backward, ignorant, and savage.
Right.
And you know, if you take that that definition, well, then I think that I would have to agree with Achebe that Conrad does portray Africans in that way. You know, of course, at the same time, he is presenting a strong criticism of the colonial practices and the brutality that went on there. So, yes, I would agree that the portrayal of Africans is racist, certainly in Achebe's definition of the term. At the same time, there is sympathy and, you know, he probably is less racist than many of his contemporaries were.
Professor Baldwin, that's what I would assume that the very strong critique that he's providing in this novel about what was going on in Africa in the colonial times would argue for the fact that this is not a racist novel. Tell me where you come down on this.
Using broad brushstrokes, I would agree with you. I think the problem of prejudice, however, is very delicate and very difficult, and that you can only confront prejudice by admitting it and living through it and feeling it honestly before you can confront it.
Mm.
And that is part of Conrad's very complex aim in this book. I think he would include himself in this. He is honestly confronting his own experience of confronting people very different than himself and being scared of them. And there's one passage in the novella, which I think Achebe draws attention to when he's looking at the African who's on the shores of the river and saying he was almost human. They were not inhuman. Do you remember that moment?
Yes, yes.
And it's a very awkward moment, and it's ripe for being called racist. But if you read that whole scene, what's going on is that Marlowe is confronting this figure who is trying to be very scary and very other to him.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing he says is, it takes a man to confront It takes some sort of manliness or courage to confront this fear. And you realize that he's talking about the figure on the bank who's looking at him, Marlowe.
Mm-hmm.
And that process of engaging what you're scared of, which includes all of his readers, and reversing your expectations, that's not an easy process. And I think that the novella is trying to take us through that. Now, does that involve prejudice? Yes, absolutely. But can you get through prejudice or past prejudice without admitting your own prejudices? I think it's very hard.
You know, as we're talking about this and we're trying to make sense of some of the scenes, I'm thinking, you know, this is in a lot of ways a pretty opaque novel. Professor Peters, maybe not to you because you've taught it so many times, but I know that's been some of the criticism, that it is difficult in this novel and some of others of Conrad's to really figure out what's happening and what he's trying to say about it.
Well, that's certainly true. Part of it has to do with how the story is told. You know, for the longest time, despite the, you know, one of the difficulties, I suppose, with the novel is the sort of murkiness of the terms that he uses. You know, he was early on criticized by a fellow named F.R. Leavis, for what he called an adjectival insistence, where you have all of these build-ups of adjectives and so forth in the text. And it's a, you know, certainly a densely packed and slow-moving narrative. But one of the other things that complicates it, I suppose, is that for the longest time I had sort of thought of it as kind of a chronological narrative, you know, because you have Marlowe who starts out looking for a job. He goes down the African coast, starts out at the coast of Africa, and then goes to the interior and comes back out again.
Mm-hmm.
As I looked at it more carefully, and as I was sort of one time hunting for passages for an article I was working on, I suddenly discovered that, in fact, it wasn't really that way at all. That instead, the narrative doesn't really move in the sequence of events, but instead in the sequence of Marlowe's thoughts. So there's this one sort of remarkable passage where he suddenly breaks out and says, "Oh, did I mention the girl?" And of course, reading that the first time, there's absolutely no way that one can have any idea who he's talking about,
right?
Because we don't meet this girl or this woman really until the end of the novel. And so I think those are a couple of things that that certainly make it difficult. The other thing that makes it difficult is that he is dealing with very difficult issues. He's really looking into the nature of Western civilization and, in a sense, the nature of human existence. And those are, you know, very difficult and profound questions about which Conrad himself doesn't have all of the answers. And so I think those are things that make the novel rather difficult.
800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. If you've just joined us, we're talking about our mid-morning book club selection as recommended to us by some listeners and by our online editor. This is one of his absolutely favorite novels, so I hope he's listening to the conversation this morning. If you want to join it, 651-227-6000, and you can reach us online at minnesotapublicradio.org and click on Send a Question to Andrew in Minneapolis. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, thanks. I didn't know this was going to be the Mid-Morning Book Club selection until yesterday.
Oh,
and I had coincidentally finished the book on Wednesday night.
Perfect.
And the interesting thing I found was that there wasn't anything significant about this novella apart from Kurtz's dying last words. And I don't understand why this book is referenced so many times and why this novella is so profound. What am I missing?
Professor Baldwin, tackle that, will you?
Well, it sounds like you weren't taken away at all by the imagery, the excitement of going to this place that seems otherworldly, primeval, that nothing of the imagery really grabbed you. And in literature, if you're not grabbed by the images, it's hard to go much further, you know, if you don't give yourself up to the sheer story of it. And I would also say that it's one of those books you can't read quickly. There's a lot in our culture that works against really biting into a good book and burrowing in and enjoying it because we tend to demand things very quickly. It's not a fast action sort of novel. So that the listener's problem with the book might be a temperamental difference as well.
But I mean, we have also said that this is and Professor Peters and I were just talking about this, that this is in some ways an opaque and difficult book, that its meaning is not clear, I think, on a first reading, or not all of its meaning. Fair or no?
Yeah, well, I would say that it purposely complicates all of our assumptions, and that it's being written in a context, or was written in a context, which is still a context that it inhabits, of moral certainty, of people who want easy answers, who think they know what civilization is and what barbarism is. And Conrad sets out to complicate this, to leave us in a state of uncertainty. And that's a great triumph to be able to do that.
You mentioned the imagery, and one of the things that I appreciated on a second reading of the novel was descriptions, and I've just rewritten a passage here that I thought I would read from the novel just to give some of our listeners who maybe haven't had a chance to go back to read it a taste of it. This is a part of the novel where I think Marlowe is describing the trip up the river. I think he's fairly early on in the journey. And he writes and he says, "Going up that river was like traveling back to the earliest beginnings of the world, when vegetation rioted on the earth and the big trees were kings. An empty stream, a great silence, an impenetrable forest. The air was warm, thick, heavy, sluggish. There was no joy in the brilliance of sunshine." Professor Peters, I get the sensation from that that he feels like he's traveling to the point of no return.
Well, yes, certainly to a point that is unfamiliar, to be sure, because, of course, this is, you know, that's part of what he does in the novel is, remove on the one hand all of the accessories or what have you of civilization. So what you have here is nature, you know, in its sort of unshackled form, you know, without streets and walls and houses and the like. And at the same time, though, he puts that together with the idea of sort of moving backwards in time, as if he's moving not just to a different place, but also a different time in the past. And then, you know, in a sense, removing all of these externals, all these things that are familiar to one in order to focus on sort of essential kinds of issues about the nature of existence and the nature of the world in which we exist.
To the phones, to Alan in St. Paul. Hi, Alan. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I just wanted to return for a second back to the comment about Chinua Achebe.
Sure.
And his biggest criticism of Conrad was more about the lack of culture with which he portrayed the people. And that was his big reason for writing Things Fall Apart the way he did. Is that he even wrote the book in English as a specific point to show that Africans do have culture. And I thought that the answer that your guest gave was sort of a gloss over of that.
Professor Peters, you want to try again?
I don't disagree with the caller. I mean, when Achebe was complaining about the European writers portraying Africans as backward, ignorant, and savage, that was, in a sense, that they were without culture and so on and so forth. And, yes, certainly the long first part of Things Fall Apart has really that as its primary purpose, to show that Africans are, in fact, not that, that instead the cultures were very sophisticated. But we're essentially saying the same thing here, that Achebe's complaint was in the portrayal of Africans and in their lacking culture, lacking intelligence, and simply being primitive and sort of instinctual or animalistic.
Professor Baldwin, do you want to add to that?
Yes, I would. It seems to me one can't have it both ways. One can't both, at least in a novella of this length, portray the sorry victims, dehumanized victims of colonialism, and also the rich cultures that might have existing somewhere on the continent. Conrad's trying to stay very close to his own experience, and what he sees are those who have been devastated by the conditions, the political conditions at that moment. Just a quick detail, he mentions that the cannibals are several hundred miles from their own homes. In other words, the cannibals on his ship are just as removed from their normal life, their laws, their customs, the things that Achebe would rightfully want to reveal and celebrate in his own literature. But that's not what Conrad's doing. That's not what he's doing, and that's not what was part of his experience.
We have a couple of online comments here, one from Lee in Mankato, another from Marianne in Chisago City, who are bringing up King Leopold's ghost. Lee says no discussion of Heart of Darkness is complete without including King Leopold's ghost. the in-your-face depiction of Belgium's rape of the Congo. And Marianne says, specifically, this work is based on the African ivory policy of King Leopold of Belgium. It's an extreme but perfect metaphor for all colonialism. Professor Baldwin, do you agree with that?
Yes. I would say it is important to focus on Belgian imperialism, at least from Conrad's point of view, as opposed to British rule of law, although that gets somewhat complicated. So that the historical fact of King Leopold, I think, is important.
All right. To the phones, to Bob in St. Paul. Hi, Bob. Hi, Bob. Are you there?
I am there.
Okay.
Yeah, we're looking at King Leopold, but also taking a look at the caller a few seconds ago who said, what's so great about it? I read it and couldn't find anything, and you responded about imagery. But I think we've got the historical context now of King Leopold, and also Conrad's use of the Inferno as a structure, moving into Kurtz as Satan, if you will, the most corrupt person. And I'm wondering if you ever touch on the structure of the novel in your analysis.
All right, Professor Peters, how about that?
I haven't really talked about that particular issue. I believe that there was a couple of articles written quite a long time ago, back in the 50s or 60s, that talked about that parallel between Heart of Darkness and Dante's Inferno. And I certainly think that there's a similar kind of structure. It might be a little bit difficult to portray Kurtz as Satan in the same way that Satan, say, appears in Dante's Inferno, simply because although Marlowe is quite clear in his depiction of the evil in Kurtz, at the same time there is that somewhat conflicted view that he has of Kurtz, you know, when he mentions that he sides with Kurtz. And so I think that although that structure does certainly work and rather effectively, the actual depicting of Kurtz as a Satan figure, he is and he isn't, I guess is what I would say, because of Marlowe's response and because of the way he portrays him.
Professor Baldwin, one of the things that I appreciated, I guess, on the second read was I liked the way that Conrad built a picture of Kurtz long before, of course, we were going to meet him, and one that was quite suspenseful in some ways. And when I was thinking about this, I went back to the book. There is this Marlowe is describing the journey, and he has just begun to hear about Kurtz. And he's talking to the captain of the steamer, I think, who says, "One day," he remarked without lifting his head, "in the interior, you will no doubt meet Mr. Kurtz." On my asking who Mr. Kurtz was, he said he was a first-class agent. And seeing my disappointment at this information, he added slowly, laying down his pen, "He is a very remarkable person." And we get little glimpses of what Kurtz may be like through the novel. Very effective. Will you talk about that for a minute?
Oh, I agree with you. In fact, that's one of the remarkable twists of the book, is when you finally get to Mr. Kurtz, he's a bit, I wouldn't say disappointing, but there's this gaping emptiness that
right.
he embodies, which is why I think that last caller made a marvelous point by noticing the allusions to Dante. And in my somewhat superficial response to that earlier caller about noting the imagery, I did not in any way mean to dismiss the layers of both literary allusion, not just Dante, but biblical Shakespeare. I mean, there you could go on and on and on, which Conrad envelops in all of his novels. But one of the wonderful ideas that the caller's reminding us of Dante's Satan is precisely that we expect that the devil is so strong, so great,
mm-hmm.
so worthy of worship. But when we get there, in Canto 34 of Inferno, he's dumb, he's big, he's frozen, he's impotent. Now, I would agree with Professor Peters that there's a more complex relation that Marlowe has with Kurtz, but what he says is that he renders Kurtz his justice.
Yeah.
And the question is, what is that? What does it mean to render him the justice that is due to that? And does Dante do the same thing with his Satan, precisely by writing the Divine Comedy.
But your point about the hollowness of Kurtz, you know, you're reading thinking this is going to be, this character is going to be somebody of great power, and Marlowe's going to feel overwhelmed when he meets him, and it's exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm. One of the many reversals in the book.
Right. Professor Peters, how about that?
Because what we get is a very different Kurtz that Marlowe meets. Right. I mean, all the depictions we've got of him is of whether they're positive or negative. What I mean by positive, negative, whether the opinions of the individuals expressing those views are positive or negative, have been of this sort of remarkable individual, who's talented, and unlike the other Europeans there that we meet, who apparently has gone out with these ideals about the colonizing mission, station manager, I believe it is, earlier on, quotes him rather disparagingly. But quotes him as Kurtz as having said, you know, that these stations are for trade, of course, but also for humanizing and improving and so forth.
Right.
And so what we expect to find is this individual who is enormously talented, which in some ways, he remains that way, I suppose. But more particularly, this idealistic individual. And we find that that's not what he's become, or at least that, he goes in and out of that in his sort of delirium after they try to set to take him home. But certainly it's a very different individual than that Marlowe had expected, or that we as readers had expected, because we had expected something closer to the way Kurtz is portrayed at the end of the book by his fiancée,
yes,
as she talks to Marlowe,
yeah,
that's the Kurtz that went out into Africa. But the Kurtz that we meet is a very different kind of Kurtz. And it's that sort of dynamic between the two, you know, in his little essay where he writes this very idealistic view of the role of Europeans and how they can be enormous agents for good and benevolence. And then at the bottom of that, as Marlowe says, evidently scrawled much later, when he says, "Exterminate all the brutes," we get this the strange, complex figure who, on the one hand, was so idealistic, but seems to have descended to such great depths.
We have an online question here from Andy in St. Paul, who writes, "Why do you think that Francis Ford Coppola chose to adapt this book to make a movie about the Vietnam War?" I thought I'd play a quick excerpt here from Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now, and then we can talk about it. Let's listen.
"It's impossible through words to describe what is necessary to those who do not know what horror means. Horror. Horror has a face. And you must make a friend of horror. Horror and moral terror are your friends. If they are not, then they are enemies to be feared. They are truly enemies."
Professor Baldwin, what do you think of that film as a representation of what Conrad was saying in his novella?
Oh, marvelous, wonderful. And wonderful because it captures the spirit rather than trying to capture the literal details.
Explain. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's trying to capture the human, the moral dilemma and the moral experience by associating to follow through the action that Conrad is describing, but in very different circumstances that perhaps the contemporary audience has very different assumptions about, but which are historically for us perhaps dealing with the same sorts of difficulties that Conrad would have been dealing with his own audience.
Mm.
Especially relevant, I might add, for current, well, the wars that might be currently underway, the experience of soldiers who have to encounter horror and then come back and integrate back into everyday life. And how does one explain that? How does one make sense of that? That's part of what Conrad was thinking about. And by re-envisioning that in contemporary circumstances, for Coppola that was Vietnam, for us it might be something else, mm-hmm. we bring life to, we animate what Conrad was trying to do, the spirit of it.
Professor Peters, what do you think of the film as representing what Conrad, some of these questions that he was wrestling with in the novel?
Well, I tend to agree. It's been many years since I've actually seen the film in its entirety, but I remember when I saw it at the time, I was very impressed by the filmmaker's ability to translate the ideas and the sort of feeling to a very different setting and a very different time, and yet in many ways he was able to choose kind of the perfect analogy, you know, a place that had such a feeling of foreignness to Americans in the way that the Congo had such a feeling of foreignness to Conrad's readers. And, you know, this sort of lack of civilization among the, in this case, the Americans in the film, as the, you know, an analogy to the lack of civilization with the Europeans that we encounter in Heart of Darkness.
Let's take another call here from Don in St. Francis. Don, I thank you for waiting.
Yes, I'd have to agree with your lady commentator. I was in colonial Africa in the mid-70s in the last French colony, Djibouti, as it was in the process and did receive independence. And I found after my return here to the States that the book was very healing for me because it, as she had stated, it is so relevant to anyone that goes to another culture and in different aspects, you know, loses one's humanity because of the nature of the environment. And I think his book definitely, and I think he also experienced trying to come to some sort of terms with, how you could say, evil and good within himself mm-hmm. and the things he saw. And so in that way, I feel it's so relevant. And I don't want to say so much we lose our civilization as we lose our humanity. And we're able to dehumanize another group to the point to where we can do great damage to.
I thank you for the call, Don. Thanks. We appreciate it. We have questions about the ending of the novel, close to the ending, where Kurtz is dying and saying the horror, the horror. Now, when I went back to read what some literary critics write about that, some say that it's an ending that doesn't befit the novel, that it leaves too many questions. He expires without elaboration. Others say it is the perfect ending, Professor Peters, because it is representative for this deeply complex, amoral man. What do you think?
Well, I would tend to side with the latter, that it is sort of the perfect response because, you know, this is a sort of open-ended novel in certain ways. We do come to certain understanding about some things, but much is left still a puzzle. And so I think that is a good assessment. But at the same time, I don't think it's quite as open-ended as, you know, some would make it to be. I mean, you know, Marlowe says elsewhere, you know, that in a sense, the most you can hope for out of life is some knowledge of yourself that comes too late.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes on to suggest, you know, that this is a sort of moral victory by Kurtz to make this assessment, that he had had something to say, that he had been able to assess presumably himself, and that he had come to that knowledge of self, but only at the very end.
Professor Baldwin?
I agree with that. I thought that was beautifully put. And I would also add, it's not the end. It's not the ending. In fact, in a letter to his publisher, Conrad himself wrote that the final scene with Kurt's
right.
fiancée
right.
Moves the story onto another plane altogether.
What? How do you interpret that?
Well, I would say, first of all, it becomes a story about the telling and not just a story about the actions that happened to Marlowe. It becomes a problem for Marlowe. How do I tell what happened to me, and what's the what story do I have to tell, and what is the justice to Kurtz? And it's something like the horror, a phrase like the horror, just those words, saying them, they are utterly empty. You need the entire novella to come to the conclusion that Professor Peters just came to, that this is Kurtz's self-assessment. If he had just said those words to Intended, how could she possibly begin to understand their content, what they mean, without having experienced that entire journey? And after lying to her, he then has to go and tell the story the proper way,
right,
which is what novel we have.
I have to say, I really do love that last, that very last scene where he is going to her, to Kurtz's fiance, and I have the book open to this section. He comes in, they sit down, she says, "You knew him well." He says, "Intimacy grows quickly out there. I knew him as well as it's possible for one man to know another." And she jumps in and says, "And you admired him. It was impossible to know him and not to admire him, was it?" And then he says, "He was a remarkable man." It's so great because they are talking at such cross purposes there. And he, what, realizes that he is not going to destroy her perception of her fiancé, yes?
Yes, and that's a huge moral problem that people argue. Should he have lied, argue over, should he have lied or not? By lying to her, does he become complicit in all of the horrors that he has participated, that Kurtz has participated in? Or by lying, does he, in fact, make a moral, engage in a moral action of some sort? How do we understand it?
Right. Right. A note here from Sarah in Bloomington. She says, "My favorite part about this novella is that it is actually a story within a story. How does the narrator play a part in the validity of the tale?" Professor Bowman, I'll ask you to talk about that.
Well, that the fact that there's a narrator who's narrating Marlowe and not just Marlowe is indeed a very deep complexity to the work. And some people think of that external narrator as being closer to Conrad himself. I tend to think of that external narrator as being Conrad's readers. Conrad's readers, because that external narrator begins the novella so smug about the history of jolly old England and the Thames, and he waxes eloquent on all of his own certainties in his armchair, or rather on the boat on the Nelly, watching Marlowe. By the end, he's immersed in gray. He's very confused. And I think that external narrator is someone who needs to be brought to a state of contemplation, of seeing the complexity, of being less certain about some of his own opinions.
Here's one last online comment from Bob in Minneapolis, who says, "I think this quote helps me make sense of this great story. He who makes a beast of himself gets rid of the pain of being a man." By Samuel Johnson. Does that make sense to you, Professor Peters, to understand the novel?
I'm not sure. I guess read it to me again.
"I think this quote helps me make sense of the great story," by Samuel Johnson. "He who makes a beast of himself gets rid of the pain of being a man."
Yeah, okay. I think I would agree with that. You know, the people that we encounter in the novel, more particularly the Europeans, primarily they do that. They have removed themselves from humanity, as in a sense, in some ways, in a way that Kurtz doesn't, in that they've become sort of amoral. You know, the chief accountant that we meet early on, who's concerned with his correct entries in his ledger books. And even the station manager, you know, who has his complaints with Kurtz's raiding the Africans, not on moral grounds, but because it's bad business, and so yes, they don't have to deal with the issues that Marlowe does, and you know, as the chief station, the central station manager makes fun of Kurtz's view about trading stations being, you know, also opportunities for humanizing the Africans and the like, or improving their state from, you know, obviously a Western perspective. You know, he doesn't have to deal with those things, and he can just simply function as someone who is simply looking out for his own interests. I would agree with that.
I thank you both for an interesting conversation, and it was fun for me to reread the novel and kind of go back to a college literature class through you. So thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Peters and Deborah Baldwin with us this morning to talk about our mid-morning book club selection, Heart of Darkness.
Send a letter to me, don't forget to write each day.
I've been hearing from a number of listeners about the show that we did on Dying with Dignity on Wednesday at 10. Dr. Craig Bowron had written a piece for the Washington Post about his concern that drugs and technology were interfering too often with the natural process of dying. Dr. Bob Kane from the U of M also joined us for the discussion as well. And within minutes of the end of the show, I was hearing from listeners who were praising the candor and the empathy of the doctors. One listener wrote to say that she would use the show as guidance for a situation that existed in her own family. Dr. Howard Epstein wrote us to Vice President of Hospice Minnesota, wrote to say that he applauded our, quote, expansion of the issues that Dr. Bowron had written about, and suggested that we schedule a discussion in the future specifically on palliative care. And we plan to do that. Nicholas Schaefer emailed to say that he's had similar conversations with his wife, who's a resident physician at the Mayo Clinic, where she faces similar issues. And he added, I think many people believe they're morally bound to put off the death as far as possible, even if it unacceptably compromises quality of life. If you miss the show, you can find it in the mid-morning archives. And if you've heard something that prompts a kudo, a critique, or a comment, I'd like to hear from you as well. You can reach me at mail@npr.org. That's mail@npr.org. One last note here. Starting next Saturday, February 7th, we're launching Mid-Morning Weekend. We're going to reprise some of the most revealing and surprising moments from the interviews on this show. It's going to air at 3 p.m. on Saturdays, just ahead of Weekend, All Things Considered. So if you're listening to the program and you hear a segment, maybe you haven't caught the whole part of the conversation, you'd like to hear more, send me a suggestion for discussions that we should reprise for our weekend show. Again, Mid-Morning Weekend at 3 o'clock. It starts next Saturday at 3 o'clock, right ahead of All Things Considered Weekend. And I'd be curious to hear what you think about the show and if there are some ideas that you can suggest to us for it. You can send that to me at mail@npr.org. Mid-Morning produced by Chris Dahl, Susan Lehm, and Nancy Liebens. Our technical directors are Randy Johnson, Clifford Bentley, and Steve Griffith. On Monday morning at 9 o'clock, we're going to be talking about the banking industry. Some interesting conversations going on in Washington about the creation of a bad bank. This would be a bank specifically created to take some of those toxic assets that exist now on the balance sheets of banks and try to bring them together in one other bank and give the other banks, the larger banks and some of the community banks, a fresh start. So we're going to talk about the idea of that. How are banks using a lot of the bailout money that they've been given? Are community banks getting any of that money? So that is Monday at 9. And then Monday at 10, our Grammy preview show, where we are going to broadcast excerpts from musicians, singers, songwriters that we've had in the mid-morning studio who have either won Grammys or been nominated. This is ahead of next Sunday's Grammy Award. So be with us on Monday. This is Mid-Morning.
Today's programming is supported by the College of St. Scholastica, offering undergraduate and graduate education for busy professionals in St. Paul, Rochester, St. Cloud, Brainerd, and Duluth. More information available at css.edu.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio.